Welcome to the Music Career Show, telling you the stories of the world's best professional musicians.
Hello there and welcome to the Music Career Show. My name is Barry and every week I'll be speaking with incredible musicians from all over the world about how they've honed their craft and made a career out of doing what they love the most. If you're a new listener, then while you still have your device in your hand, please take a second to subscribe and tell your friends all about the Music Career Show.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Career Show. Today's guest is a tour manager all the way from Dublin. I was first introduced to him back, I'd say nearly 15 years ago at this stage, when he played guitar in a band called Magic 8 Ball, Magic with a K, so K-M-A-I. And we've been Facebook friends ever since. I've been keeping an eye on what he's been up to just in the background ever since. And this is the first time we've actually ever spoken in real life outside of Facebook Messenger. So this has been 15 years in the making. This is Andrew Callaly. Morning, Andrew. How are you getting in? How are you getting on?
How about?
I can't complain, though. You're in Helsinki currently, are you?
Yes.
What's the weather like in Helsinki?
-3, -4.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I'm in Aberdeen, so I'm like not too far in the way in the world from you, but it's like, it's icy, it's cold, it's not warm. Like. But anyway, so Andrew, for the person that is getting introduced to you for the first time, why don't you introduce yourselves to them and say hello to them, tell them who you are and what you're about and all that.
Well, as you said, my name is Andrew and I'm born, raised in sunny Dublin. And for the last 7 years, I've been a tour manager, which has taken me around the world to places I never thought I'd be and experiences never thought I had. But like most of us, I did start off as a musician as well, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of reached the glass ceiling there, but that's a story we'll get into, I guess.
100%. So let's actually get into that story then and ask, where did music all start for you? How did you get into it in the first place?
It was kind of, for me anyway, you know, sports was the biggest thing in my life for a long time. Played football, played it, you know, St. Pat's, Drogheda, all that, you know, had a great time doing that. It was every moment of my life. Yeah. Always behind that was always into music. I don't have a very musical family, but it started off, I think, like 4 years old with Queen. Queen was the biggest thing. And then like everybody else, you fall into, like at that time, it was Eminem and stuff like that. And then I heard I Believe in a Thing Called Love by The Darkness, and that was it.
Oh, lad.
That was it. You know,
By any chance, did you hear that for the first time on the Late Late Tie Show?
I can't even remember what it was. I just remember hearing the opening riff and being like, what's that? How do I do it? And where do I do it? And I had kind of missed the Permission to Land thing, but they were in between Permission to Land and One Way Ticket, so they were already falling apart. And then I went to see them in the Point Depot, as it was at the time.
Yeah, that's going back.
That was it. Yeah, there was no coming back from that. And then it was, okay, Les Paul and a Marshall. Well, what else is a Les Paul and a Marshall? Well, obviously Thin Lizzy, So Close to Home.
Yeah.
Slash, you know, else is all that. Then, of course, fell into LA Guns, which is its own story.
And,
of course, Van Halen, you know, that was it. So that was really where it became a thing. And, you know, I had Guns N' Roses Live at the Budokan, 92.
Yeah, great album.
This acoustic guitar, and then I had the videos, like the collection or whatever, you know, Don't Cry and November Rain and all this stuff. And,
oh, I had that as well on DVD.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so
I had that. It was great.
Trying to figure that out without realizing that they weren't actually playing the notes on the video.
I know.
I think that was the summer of 2006, and that's really where I like fell into guitar and fell into everything. And course then, as you mentioned, fell into Magic 8 Ball, which is something I haven't thought about in a very very long time.
Imagine,
we had great fun, you know. It was that real classic, like cutting your teeth kind of thing, just playing anything and with anybody and everybody. So it's funny you mentioned that. I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
No, I remember. I have absolutely no idea how I would have came across you, because this was well before even like hashtags and things like that would have brought you to things that you're interested in or whatever. So the algorithm was probably working in my favor back then even. But I remember just seeing you guys and you had the George Lynch LTD, Tiger Stripe. And I was like, that is the coolest fucking thing going. I was like, yes, I want to be friends with that guy. We couldn't have been much more than about 13, 14.
I mean, it would have been, if I got that in like 2010, I think. So it would have been 16. Yeah, but I still have it. It was a nightmare. It's always been a nightmare. It looked great, but it was...
Oh, really? Yeah. Wait, what was wrong with it?
It just was horrible. The bridge, everything was you know. But at that point, you don't care. Just plug it in and play. Yeah,
you've got a Tiger Stripe guitar. Yeah, who gives exactly. A fuck after that, right? Yeah. I mean,
and it really, I guess people kind of knew that, even though they didn't know what George Lynch was. You know,
yeah.
they knew those colors and stuff, which was great. You know, it set it apart from everybody else with their Les Paul Juniors and stuff. Not there's anything wrong with that, but it was something different. And I guess we were the only ones at 16 years of age doing that type of thing. From there, obviously, we did the Magic 8 Ball thing, and that was great. You know, you really there is such a great scene in Dublin. Well, there used to be. I don't know. I don't really know now. You know,
no, I wouldn't know either.
But there seems to always be something going, or somebody gigging, or you know, Fibbers, or whatever else is there. And we did all that. And then I remember in 2015, went to see Corrosion of Conformity at the Academy, and I went with Gav, who was the drummer. So shout out to Gav. And he said, you know, Andy, I've got this other band on the go, and I'm gonna go give that a look. And he said, maybe you should think about doing something too. I don't know. It was a case of. It's not you, it's me type of thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of went, okay. So there happened to be an ad on Facebook for a band called Stone Trigger. They were looking for a guitar player, and I was a guitar player looking for a band. So I responded to the ad, and within I think 2 weeks we were in the band, and within 4 weeks we were on our very first tour of the UK. Which at the time felt like a surreal thing. Like you know, as you said about, you know, getting to Dublin and that being the big city and stuff like that, even getting to the UK to play, you know, 10 gigs in a row, that was like incredible, you know. You know, that was with Tracy from LA Guns and Rudy Sarzo from Whitesnake and Dio. And so
he played with Ozzy as well, I think, Rudy. Well,
of course, and Riot, you know. So to start.
Oh, quite close, quite right. Yeah, Jesus.
To start a touring career with people like that, you know, that was. Where,
it doesn't get better than that.
Where else do you go? And as you know, five of us in a van, you know, on top of each other for 10 days, all the gear in the back, and all the gear on sleeping on top of the gear, and you know, it's just it was amazing. You know, it was absolutely amazing. Yeah. You 10 days feels like 10 minutes in that situation.
Totally. I toured America myself 10 years ago now at this stage, and like you say, I was there for like. I think 6 weeks was the longest I was there. Maybe five, 6 weeks. Looking back on it, it seems like 5 minutes, genuinely. I remember when you got into Stone Trigger, because I knew who Stone Trigger were, because we had a lecture. We had a lecturer in Pulse called Mick Richards. You probably know Mick. Yeah. He was our lecturer, and he was working with Stone Trigger at the time that he was our lecturer. So can't remember if we ever, we probably didn't do anything along the lines of mixing things. I don't want to get Mick into trouble, but I remember him telling us all about Stone Trigger, and me, 18 years old, with hair down to my arse nearly, and playing a sparkly red guitar, I was like, that's the coolest fucking thing I've ever heard. I loved it. So then when I saw a couple of years later and putting two and two together, that was so, so cool. I loved that. I absolutely loved that. It was amazing. So let's reverse back a little bit, because we're going to be getting into like your touring business. It is your business, isn't it? Yeah, we're going to be getting into that, and we're going to ask about that in a minute. But first instruments then. So you were saying football kind of sport was your big thing. Did you ever go for lessons? Did you ever, or did you just self-taught, or did you literally just do what I did and look at Slash's hands and try and do that?
I did the classic kind of lessons for a year, and that was really, 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 really good. And then I went, I had a guitar teacher by the name of Martin Doyle, and it was less of a guitar, you know, scales and whatnot. It was, I want to learn this and I want to do that. And yeah, like this. So probably all in all, I would say somewhere between self-taught and somewhere between thought. But looking back at it now, I wish I had done more. You know,
oh, really?
Yeah, I really do wish I had done more. I feel I got into the guy in the band thing very fast. When I look at all the great players, you know, like all the really great players, and then I've been lucky to work with some really great players. The stuff that they make money from, or their career, that's the least thing that they do. They've got the guitar in their hand all day, and they're playing, you know, Spanish style, they're playing pop, they're playing finger style, they're playing jazz. Mm-hmm. So it's less about the actual rock chords and solos now.
Yeah.
So now I look back at it, I think, well, maybe it was a 50-50 thing where you got out in the world and you got the experience as soon as you could kind of, okay, well, this riff sounds good and that amp sounds good and let's do this. But then maybe I didn't think outside the box enough. And I'd love to go back and be more theory knowledgeable, which I have zero of. Obviously, I studied music in secondary school, and then I did go to BIM for a year.
Oh,
emphasis
yeah.
on a year. Just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Just wasn't.
Why not? What was the barrier there?
I suppose, like you said, we were gigging in pubs and clubs and everything with a stage from whatever the age of 14. So I remember one time sitting there and thinking, okay, well, I really want to make a career of this. But if all my eggs are in that basket and it doesn't work, what do I fall back on? So you go for it in music, and then it falls apart. And the only thing you have to fall back on is music. So that kind of played in my mind an awful lot. And it just wasn't for me. And I mean, I know a lot of people. I've got so many good friends that have been through it and love it, absolutely love it.
I've got friends of mine. Yeah.
It just wasn't for me personally.
Fair enough.
I have no idea why, but it just wasn't for me. I think the biggest thing was we were going through kind of guitar styles, and they went through the 50s, and then they went through the 60s, and then they got up to the 70s, and that was all great, and it was Mark Bolan, and it was all this. And then you got to the 80s, and it was like that. And it was like, okay, well, there was Eddie Van Halen and these guys. Let's move on to the 90s. And I was like, wait a minute.
Ah, you can't do that at all. You can't do that. That's stupid.
But if you're talking about, okay, if you can take the spandex and the out of it, but there were some good guitar players in that era.
Yeah.
Some great guitar players in that era.
Yeah. I literally just, you might have seen it, that Sammy Hagar and Michael Anthony were on the Howard Stern show. Like yesterday or today. So as we're recording this today, folks, let anyone listen, it's the 17th of November 2023. And actually tickets for that Best of All Worlds, I think is what they're calling it, a tour is going on sale today, and it's over in America. And I've tried every which way to figure out how I can get over to America to go and see it, because the likelihood of anyone from Van Halen ever playing over this end of the world again is very, very slim. But anyway, and looking back on, did you see Joe Satriani trying to do Mean Street?
Yeah.
Give me your opinion on that. Was it good? Was it close?
It was close, but there's no replacing. Yeah. There's no replacing the King.
There's absolutely no replacing the King. And even Summer Nights, I was watching it as well. I watched it about an hour ago. I'm watching Joe Satriani, not struggle, but someone of Joe Satriani's caliber, and then not actually being able to even... I didn't think he came close. Like, I'm a huge Van Halen fan, massive Van Halen fan. Like, that's my phone cover. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And in fact, I like showing everyone this. There's Eddie 1, and then there's the brand new Eddie 2. So, like, you know what I mean? I'm a big child when it comes to that sort of stuff. But the fact that Joe Satriani, being Joe Satriani, couldn't even come close to it, and the fact that you're now saying that you literally in BIM sort of just brushed over that. Mean Street was 1981 and Summer Nights was 1986. That's the 80s. Do you know what I mean? You can't brush over that. You just can't. Do you know what I mean? Who did Mean Street back in the 70s? Who did Mean Street in the 90s? Nobody.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So the fact that, yeah, well, to be fair, I'd have been browned off of that as well.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't have been.
And the other, the funniest story of it all is the modules were, they were great, you know. It was really like living in a, what, I guess it's not designed for people to become quote unquote rock stars. It's designed for people to become session musicians and stuff like that.
Make a career out of it.
Yeah, of course. And I remember the weekly song thing and weekly performance thing. And it was this drummer, and he's in a lot of Irish bands now. I won't go into his name, but he was incredible. Like, he was absolutely incredible. The whole performance, it didn't matter what the song was, it was all about him, you know. And it was just in it, just visual, on the money, everything was great. I'm looking at him going, man, yeah, okay. Yeah, let's get a band together here with this guy, something like that, you know. And I remember him stopping the song and saying, okay, you at the back there, you know, you just play the drums and you just ease into the background there. And I was like, well, that's it for me. But it's a different way of thinking. You know, you're talking about, like you, you're talking about a guy who, like, you know, Van Halen live at Oakland. That's my thing. You know, it's all
1989.
It's all singing and dancing and hair and kicks and everything, you know, how many amps do you need more, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a different train of thought. You know, you're talking about Hollywood versus Dublin, and that's fine. That's fine. Like I said, it just wasn't for me, and I'm okay to admit that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I done 2 years of sound engineering in Pulse, and I never really used it until 10 years later when I started my own teaching business and doing podcasts and doing videos and stuff like that. So it was good to have, but kind of like you, I was like, anytime we were recording a band, I couldn't have had less interest in being in the engine room. I wanted to be the one with the headphones on. Do you know what I mean? That was me. Or the one that was, if we were doing sound for a band, I couldn't have given a fuck about doing sound for them. Like, even though I was doing it, do you know what I mean? I was learning how to do it. It stood me well. But so, no, it's just interesting to hear. I've had some people on the podcast that have been to BIM. I know some people that otherwise that have been to BIM, and they've all had different experiences of it. It's good to hear just someone else's experience of it. So, in that same sort of vein then, were you ever going to be anything that wasn't a musician or someone in the music industry? Was there ever anything else on the cards in terms of career, like?
No, I don't think so. I've never worked a real job, you know. It's always been this world or the sports world, you know. Like when I really started touring, I was 21. So that's all I've pretty much known. And I guess I would have maybe teaching, something like that. Yeah. And at the end of all this, you know, that's what I'd love to do, would to kind of teach people how to do this tour management thing, or because there's no I was just talking about that with somebody today. There is no, it's like the Secret Service, you know. There's no training center, or there's no anything like that. It's just here you go, you're going to do this job and figure it out. Yeah,
love it.
And it's great. It's absolutely great. But I would love to be able to say, okay, well, here's what you need to do. And that's only my opinion. It doesn't mean that I'm doing it the right way or somebody else doing it the wrong way. But it would just be great to have, because there are a lot of things that go into it, you know, immigration and customs and everything, you name it. It's all there. It will be nice to, so some, maybe something in teaching, but I never looked beyond the music industry.
Well, let's speak about that then. So you went and you started playing for Stone Trigger, and you were touring around and all that kind of jazz. When did you finish up? Because I'm assuming that you finished up with Stone Trigger. Now, when did you finish up with Stone Trigger, or when did you finish up with being just Andy Andrews, guitar player?
Pretty much for 2019 was the real, like, okay, we're gonna do this full time. But I kind of been moonlighting between the two from 2017 or so. But 2019, it really became, okay, the guitar has to go away for a while, and we're gonna do the other thing.
Yeah,
which was a hard adjustment, because you always think that you always miss that moment of, excuse me, walking out on the stage or whatever. But now it's a different feeling of accomplishment when everything comes together. So yeah, I would say 2017 we did quite a lot of touring with Stone Trigger. 2018 we did a little bit more, and I guess the biggest for me, the defining moment of it all was we'd done all the European tours, and we'd put out the album and all that stuff, and then we came back to Dublin and we did the Vibe for Philo in 2018. Classic. And as an originals band, to be playing that was the biggest honor that we could have asked for.
Oh, so you did all your own stuff at the Vibe?
No, well, we did the Lizzie stuff, but
still though,
it as that, and you know, I think we did Killer on the Loose, we did Cold Sweat, we did Hollywood, Emerald, and Waiting for an Alibi. So kind of the guitar centric stuff. So it was
fantastic.
It was a great two evenings, and it was a great honor to come back and do that. And
yeah,
we had all the kind of previous members of the band were there, and everybody was there. And to me personally, that should have been the end.
Okay.
You know, we'd kind of done it, and there we go. But then we came back for one more tour in 2018, and we did that. And at the end of that tour was when it was like, okay, well, next year we'd like you to come to America, and we'd like you to take up the role as tour manager of LA Guns. And that was the beginning of the real tour management aspect.
Right. So how did that? So who is we? Who is that we? Is that Tracy Guns or?
Yeah. So at the time, Tracy was managed by a guy called Scotty Ludwig, who's my mentor, I guess. And he was moving into he was tour managing, and then he was moving into management, and they needed somebody to fill that role. And for some reason, they fell on me. And obviously, I toured with Tracy and Phil and all those guys many times before that. And they needed a guitar tech as well, so I fit both those roles, and I probably held that I could play guitar as well, just in case. So we just threw caution to the wind and went for it.
Right.
I think we did over 200 shows together, before and after COVID, you know, so it's a real, you know, look, they were, like, Tracy was my favorite guitar player. I'm not afraid to say that. And Ellie Guns was a massive Ellie Guns fan. So to do that for a living was... Yeah, let's do it. Where do I sign? Where do I go?
Absolutely.
And what a way to start it, you know? Again, guys whose legacy is long cemented before I was even born.
Totally. Oh, yeah, totally. Jesus, I've known Tracy Guns' name since I've I've had a guitar, do you know what I mean? And LA Guns and all that. I've known these names growing up. So that's I can only imagine how surreal that is. How did you find going from being a guitar player in a band to then all of a sudden having a totally different job role? Like, it can't have been overnight. You must have been like you said, you were moonlighting. What did that look like while you were doing it? Do you know what I mean? Am I asking that question correctly? Do you know what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, it mentally, I guess you're saying to yourself, well, you know, the more I get into the tour management, the further I'm getting from the playing part.
Yeah, totally.
But then I also have to stand back and say, well, okay, you can actually make a living from this now. Or at least you have the opportunity to make a living from this now.
Absolutely.
So I guess it was like an identity crisis for a little while, because you want to be on stage, you want to be in the band at that point. Then I realized, well, wait a minute, I absolutely love, and even now, whatever it is, 5 years later, I wake up every morning and I think I've got the best job in the world.
Class.
And absolutely fantastic. And not many people can say that. So it was quite an easy transition in that regard. But it was also it was also like learning on the job, you know.
So that's kind of what I was asking. Is like, what qualified you to be tour manager for Guns N' Roses? Jesus Christ, don't do that. For LA Guns, what qualified you to be tour manager for LA Guns?
Well, I guess when I was doing the Stone Trigger thing, because the guys had families and the guys had responsibilities, I was already taking care of like getting the buses and getting the gear and schedules and stuff like that. So I was always learning it without knowing.
Intended,
I was learning it. So that, I guess they saw that I was doing that. And they said, okay, well, you know, there's youth on my side as well. So it's time to mold it.
Yeah.
So that seemed to be what qualified. I don't know. I don't know. It was like, phone rang. Yeah, sure, let's do it. Absolutely. Where do I sign up? And I'm going to fake it till you make it anyway. So
big time. And please don't take that as I'm like, well, who the fuck
not at all. I've done for 5 or 6 years.
No, I'm coming at it from the point of view of if someone was wanting to get into, and we will get into the nitty-gritty of what you actually do on a day to day, but if someone was wanting to get into it, if someone like you said there earlier on, you were kind of looking to, there's no training center. You can't just go down to Foss and say one tour manager job, please. Do you know what I mean? You can't do that. You're wanting to kind of help people, teach people how to do that. If someone was wanting to get into that, have you got any advice to little Andrew down there in Dublin or wherever he is 5 years ago to get into it? What would you advise them to do? Or is there any advice? Do you just have to be in the right place at the right time? Or
I think you have to be in the right place at the right time. Really, really, I do. But there's always avenues. There really is. You know, you go work for your local venue, you know, coiling cables.
Yeah.
And then you hopefully work your way up to where you're at the point where when bands are coming through, they see you and they say, well, you know, something happens and they say, well, that guy that was in working in the Olympia or working in Vicar or working in wherever, he was great. Let's get him.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best way, I think. As I said, I just got lucky.
Very good. Very good. Well, may your luck continue. I don't know what was I trying to say. Long may your luck continue. That's what I was trying to say. So what is the day to day of a tour manager look like then?
Chaos. No. To me, a lot of the work is done in the advance of the tour. So, you know, 5 or 6 weeks out, sending out the the tech packet, sending out the riders, sending out the events. Basically, here's what we need. Here's what we're bringing. Here's what we need from you. That's really where it starts. And then I think when I get there, it's just about putting that in place and making sure that everything is copacetic. Of course, it's like moving a small village around in a way, you know, because you might have two buses, two trucks, and then with that you might have 15, 16 people. Then you've got 15, 16 people plus the house crew plus whatever. So it's all about really just being detail orientated and organized and keeping it on schedule, making sure that everybody's department is at its best. And I've been so lucky to work with so many great teams that I don't have to worry. They do their thing and I do my thing, and I know that their thing is going to be great. And if they need anything, I'll of course help them with what I can. But when it comes to the actual lights and sound, they're their own artists. You know, they've been so lucky. So it really is about just implementing the best laid plans and all that, I guess.
Right.
Because anything can happen. You're talking about, you know, you might be on the road for 6 weeks and somebody mightn't be in the same headspace they were 4 weeks ago. So
yeah,
you're hoping that everybody comes together and everything falls into place, which it does most of the time, but you have to be ready for the time that it's not. And security. Security is the biggest thing. Security and safety. That for me is the most important thing, that everybody that comes to the gig leaves the gig, and everybody that's coming to work at the gig leaves the gig as well at the same time. But really, it's all in the advance section.
Very good. Have you ever had anything go completely tits up?
Yeah, we were in Terre Haute, Indiana. Now, there's a place. There's the one on the Abbey travel agent guy, Terre Haute, Indiana. Leaving the hotel, and the promoter called and he said, hey, just want you to know that we blew out a cone on the speaker last night, so we're going to replace the right side of the PA. Okay. Get to the venue, go in the door. This guy just comes, storming, effing and blind. And like, it was one of those push doors and I was trying to open, and he just nearly cleaned me out with it. Like, okay.
All right. About?
So he's wheeling this thing. I said, oh, great. You know, he must be helping us with the PA. And I walked in, I said, where's the problem with the PA? They said, there is no PA. He just took the PA and that's why he's in that state. You know, so that was 2 p.m.
And he'd be starting about 7 a.m.
because that's 7 and there's no PA, you know,
a bit of an issue.
So they had to drive the PA from, you know, 190 miles away, and then it wasn't the right one. And it was just a comedy of errors. We got it in the end, but just storming out with the PA on his little dolly truck, you know, it was good. But you know, that was probably the highlight of it all. I've been pretty lucky to avoid too many skirmishes like that. But it's like, when you show up to a gig, the thing you expect probably the least is that the PA is going to be walking out as you're arriving.
Absolutely. And things along the lines of then the infamous Van Halen story of the brown, is it brown or blue M&Ms? Brown M&Ms. For anyone that doesn't know what that is, it just very, very quickly, it was David Lee Roth explained it in an interview, I don't know how many years ago, it was that Van Halen always used to have on the rider, they used to have a bowl of M&Ms, but with all the brown ones picked out. And if they went into the dressing room and found one brown M&M, the logic behind it was that if the people in the venue couldn't do something as simple as pick out the brown M&Ms, have they left out something serious, like an electrical thing or an equipment thing or safety, security, something along those lines. Do you guys do anything along those lines, or am I asking you to reveal your secrets?
I used to have like fridge magnet from the town that you were playing in, have that on there. Haven't had that on in a while because running out of space, but it's just something to keep them guessing, you know. And nothing to the extreme of that, because you know, how can you top brown M&Ms?
You can't. There's no topping it. There's absolutely no topping it. That story always reminds me of, do you remember Wayne's World 2 and the old fella talking about we had to beat him to death with his own shoes? Are you talking about M&Ms or Aussie wanted M&Ms or something fucking mental like that? Anyway, great crack. But so a fridge magnet, and is that the same sort of idea, just to make sure that they've read the rider thoroughly and the text back?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because you've got it on there, whatever, you know, 58 cans of Fanta, 28 cans of Coke Zero. So if you throw in a fridge magnet, it kind of throws it off a little bit. Yeah.
And what sort of things then do bands actually genuinely ask for on writers? Because you hear about, oh, we need fucking 10 litres of Grey Goose vodka, and we need fucking a million Marlboro Red and 10 fucking this, that, and the other. Like, what sort of things do bands actually ask for?
It depends from band to band, and it depends on, I guess, if you've got, like, catering and stuff like that. Because if you've got catering, then you don't need sandwiches and you don't need that because it's all over there. So,
yeah,
I guess, obviously, as much water as you can think of. That's the big thing, be it still or sparkling. And then you've got the kind of people that ask for toothpaste or toothbrush or stuff like that, just in case. But it's anything I've been involved in, it's been fairly on this planet, you know.
Yeah. There's been nothing outrageous.
No, nothing outrageous. And, you know, it's just comforts. You know, it's the same thing as when you're in your house and you want to go to the fridge, or you want to go to the press and take something out. You just want to have that there, and if it's a little piece of home, it's a little piece of home. So, and whatever, you know, cereal, or for me, I like to have Philadelphia cream cheese. That's my thing. But anything, it can be anything. Nothing. I've never come across anything completely outrageous. You know, some will have Jack Daniels, some will have wine, some will have beer. Yeah, you know,
yeah.
There's never anything too, well, I would consider too crazy anyway.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. And have you ever had a situation where the writer hasn't been fulfilled or anything along those?
Yeah, lines? But you've got to, that's where you kind of got to accept certain things. Like if you're in, I just came back from South America, so they mightn't have what they have in the US and what they have in the US. So if you're kind of hooked onto a certain brand or a certain, that's kind of where it can go wrong, but you just have to kind of ebb and flow with it.
Fair enough. So one thing I wanted to ask you in particular was, as a tour manager, right, you're all over the world. You're here, there, you're everywhere. Do you have any fixed location where you call home?
Yeah, Dublin is home.
Dublin is home. And have you got your own place in Dublin and all that kind of jazz?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. How often are you actually there?
This year, I think I've been on the road for nearly 200 days. So during festival season, I would leave home on a Wednesday or Thursday, back on Sunday, same again. So this year in particular has been really busy. So it hasn't been much time at home. I have a bit of a break to the end of the year from gone. So hopefully that will help that a bit. But since COVID, since the break, I've just been trying to keep it as much as it comes. You know, don't put a thing in the face. And then
how does that sit with you, like, on a personal level? Again, if you don't want to answer this, you don't have to. But how does it sit with you on a personal level, the fact that you are away from home? Do you know what I mean? You, I would imagine, and I'm just going on what I know about these things, I'd imagine you're living out of a suitcase most of the time. You probably don't have those comforts of home a lot of the time. It's not as if you have a bad day, you can just go home, put your feet up and get a beer out of the fridge. You're kind of going back to a hotel, or you're going back to wherever you are. How does that sit with you? Does that suit you, or would you rather it was different, or what do you think?
No, look, of course, you know, you miss home, and you miss those at home.
Yeah.
But we're not out here fighting a war, you know. We're so, as I said, so privileged to do it.
Totally.
It's a choice you make. You know what you're getting into.
There
is that, of course. You know, you talk to people and they say, well, you know, if you're working in a bank, or you're working a 9-to-5, you get to go home at night. So technically, we work twice because we go to work and then we don't get to go home. So, yeah, I mean, of course, you miss the small things. There are times when you say, "Oh, yeah, I'd love to just go home for 5 minutes, or just sit on the couch, or whatever." But then at the same time, you're probably sitting on the couch going, "Man, I wish I was in."
What are the lads?
Yeah,
up to?
Exactly. So I've been lucky that, you know, I've had the opportunity, and it does play a lot on your mind. And as I say, 200 days this year, you don't notice it go by. But then you realize
that
you're missing things and you're not there for certain things, or time has, it's a weird bubble, You know, even though you know time has gone by, you're in that tunnel vision the whole time, that when it's over, it's like, whoa, where am I now?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's I love it. I love it. I wouldn't change it for the world. Yeah.
Good. No, that's good, because that's one thing that, like I'm currently in a little studio in my garden here. I'm like 10 steps from my back door. That's as far as I go. And I teach out of here. I work from home, and I even begrudge driving into town on a Friday night to go and do a gig, because it's too far away from home. And I used to tour. So I would be the total opposite. I would literally have to be in LA Guns or Van Halen or be in one of these bands, you know what I mean, to make it worth me while to actually go and do that on the road again. So I do always like to hear it from other people's perspective, that and it's lovely to hear that people still love doing it. It's still worth doing. And things like then, and again, I'm asking on behalf of people out there that are listening and don't have the opportunity to ask it themselves. Do you ever get, this might sound like a stupid question, but do you ever get an opportunity to have a day off, go for a pint with the lads, go for a walk in the park, go do whatever it is?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were lucky this year that all the days off were in major cities, Amsterdam, Orlando, Milan, Vegas, So yeah, we try and make the time. And then there are some days where it's just, you just hotel and that's it. You know, there's no more, no less. Sorry, that was me.
Right.
Hotel, no more, no less. But yeah, we get together and we dinner or whatever. You know, I think we did the House of Blues in Orlando, and in between soundcheck and the gig, we went to Disney World. So we managed to figure it out. You know, you don't get to see you don't get to see as much of it as you would like, of course.
I was here,
I was there, but were you really?
Yeah.
A lot of the guys are really good at it. They're really good at getting out there and going and seeing the city and stuff like that. And then sometimes you might just not have the time, and you just have to accept that, you know.
Where's the coolest place that you've been?
I mean, for me, the place I always wanted to visit was Brazil. So Sao Paulo was definitely, that was one on the bucket list for sure.
Class. What's that like?
Busy. There's a lot of people. Cars everywhere. Noise everywhere. Chaos.
Yeah. No, I've never been anywhere near South America, but yeah, it's one of those that's on the bucket list as well. So that's absolutely class. So you've got your current roster of acts. Mm-hmm. Are they signed to you? Like they'd be signed to a label?
No.
So how does that relationship work then between a tour manager and an act?
It's like anything else. It's like any other kind of independent contractor. It's which is what it is. I've been lucky. In January of 22, I started working with Backbone Management, with their artists. They're based here in Thinky. They had needed a tour manager for one of their younger bands, Blind Channel, who were on the Eurovision. I think they finished sixth or fourth. It was the same year as Maneskin won it.
All right, yeah.
They needed a tour manager, and I had an open space, and we went out and we did 8 weeks together, and that was awesome. It was really great tour, and it was kind of the first real one that I had done post COVID. Whilst they were learning the ropes, I was relearning the ropes.
Home for
2 years trying to remember, will I ever do this again, or will it ever be a thing again? From there, then they their manager also manages the Rasmus, so he offered me that. We did that last year, October of last year, Live and Never Die tour. And then from there, moved on to VV, Vile Valo, former singer of Him, which is what we're doing this year. And we've done 117 shows. So it's been a great, that's been a great, the greatest honor that I've had to do that and work with those, that Him, no pun intended, and the crew and everything else. So it just seems if you get in with a company and they trust you, then the work keeps coming, which I'm incredibly grateful of. So it's not kind of like it's not kind of the same as being signed to a label or being signed to a management company or whatever like that. It's just a case of who needs what, really. That's what it is, and who's available, and kind of how it fits and schedules. That's all it is, the schedules.
Yeah. So is it literally just knowing the right people, word of mouth?
Word of mouth, really. That seems to be it. Or working with one person once and they think, well, I liked working with that guy. You liked working with them, and they have something and they need a position filled, or somebody knows somebody, which it's a very small circle at the end of the day.
Oh, okay. Right. So what I was going to ask was, is there a kind of a way to manufacture this work? Like if you were looking for a gig, for example, you just go on Canvas to pubs, or if you're looking for students, music students, you go on Canvas to local Facebook groups, whatever it is, or you make ads. But like there doesn't seem to be a way to actually manufacture this type
of
work.
There's a couple of sites out there. There's like bobnet.com, you know. Okay. So it's basically the Craigslist for touring personnel. So it's all the job listings and position listings, and from anybody from like the very top at Metallica all the way down to whoever, you know, just somebody needs something and they just put it out there, and that seems to be a good way as well. But it's always good to get in and get to know the people and know the faces, and you know, well, I work with this guy, so maybe, hey, they need a sound engineer or they need whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
The true way of doing it, but to actually get to that point, filling out or finding one of those ads isn't a bad thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Yeah. No. I never knew that. Imagine seeing an ad that Metallica needs.
Yeah.
Someone.
Yeah. You would hope they wouldn't advertise it that it was them, but.
That's quite cool. What about then the guitar tech side of things? Because obviously you were saying that you done guitar tech for Tracy. What sort of things does a guitar tech need to do? Need to know how to do for starters, and need to actually do then on the road.
Yeah, well, of course, you need to know what the artist wants, which is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to preface by saying I was probably the worst guitar tech in the world. I just got away with it because I knew how to play guitar. I'm not even afraid to say that. I'll put that on my CV. I'm not afraid to say it. But really, just about knowing the instrument, knowing what the artist wants. It could be anything. I mean, you're talking about instruments that might be, if it's a good Les Paul, you know, it might be whatever, 50, 60 years old, and it's going into the back of a truck, and then it's coming out of a truck, and it's, you know, it's going 600 miles, and then is it in the same condition that it was in last night when we saw it as when we see it today? So maybe you're changing strings every day, maybe every second day, checking out, making sure all the wiring is still correct, all the joints, all the soldering points, the action, of course, which is, of course, suffers from weather and bouncing and everything else. So that was just the maintenance of the instrument, really, was the most important thing. And you could have somebody that has two guitars or 10 guitars, but each one is just as important as the last, as you know. So it was really just making sure that everything was in tip top, a bit like a Formula One pit crew, you know, just make sure it's how it is and pray that nothing goes wrong in that 60 minute slot, you know, which more often than not something will
crop up,
you know.
Yeah, like kind of like you say with the tour and stuff, I'd imagine most of the work is done beforehand, loading up guitars, making sure you have, I don't know, enough strings and you've got plenty of backup pots or whatever other sorts of things. There's one that I've just thought of now. Strings. Do you just go to Walton's and say, can I have 3 months worth of strings? Or like, how does that sort of relationship work?
Well, it would depend on, I guess, the artist. If the artist has an endorsement with Ernie Ball or Dunlop or whoever there is now.
D'Addario, whoever, Elixir.
Just go and say, okay, we're going out for, you know, we've got, let's say, 50 shows and we've got 10 guitars and probably each guitar is going to need da-da-da-da-da. So send me this and then they'll send you, if depending on what the deal is, you know, they'll send you what you need. Same with guitar picks. Which, you know, you can never have too many of, apparently.
No.
but yeah, it depends on who has what deal and where. But it would be nice to look at the Waltons and say, give me the whole left-hand aisle and I'll be gone. Now, is Waltons even a thing anymore? I don't know.
I don't know. I think it is. I think Waltons is. That whole kind of, that used to be the most amazing thing about Dublin was, When I went up to Dublin anyway, to hear me, as if it was in the middle of fucking nowhere. Anyway, when I went to Dublin and when I started going to Dublin for college and stuff like that, Exchequer Street, and then just across the road, so you had like, oh my God, what were it even called? Music Maker, that's what it was. And then there was another one, was it Music Minds?
Yep.
Or something, Music Minds, yeah. I remember going in there one day and they had an OLP Axis, which was kind of the cheaper version of Eddie Van Halen's Music Man. And this was just when the Bugera stuff came out. So Behringer's kind of high-end Valve stuff. And yeah, I don't know why I remember that specifically, but anyway. But there was loads of little music shops there, and then there was Walton's. I think Walton's is still there. Music Maker, I'm not entirely sure. Is it still there? That's good. I'm glad that's still there. That's got memories. But I think it's an awful lot smaller than it would have been when I was going
there. Once the Toman and stuff like that became prevalent, that was it, you know.
Yeah, that was, yeah, that literally was it. Yeah, because they can't really keep up. No, you can't, because there's only two lads in the whole country that actually want it, and we're both of them. So
kind of supply and demand, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There was one there that there was another one that you, that eventually became X Music. Can you remember what it was? It was a tiny little one.
No, that's going to eat me alive now for the rest. But I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, I don't know what it was.
Yeah. That was the first time I ever saw a poster that says No Stairway or it might have even been Enter Sandman, actually. Do not play Enter Sandman or something like that. Oh, what the fuck was it called? I'm going to have to go back and Google that. Mm-hmm. I'll go back and Google that, and I'll tell you later on. Graham, well, I'll tell you what. That has been hugely interesting. Let us start moving on and start finishing up. But before we do, what's next for you? Andrew, what is on the cards? Where are you off to next?
Yeah, I got to be leaving here, Helsinki, on Sunday, going to Mexico, do a private gig out there, come back, and then I'll be working on the Eddie Trunk 40th year in music show in Las Vegas in December.
Very good.
So that's being headlined by Michael Anthony and Sammy Hagar. So funny you mentioned them. Yeah. And so that's...
tell him I said hello, will you?
That's quite the thrill, let's say. And then this year out, I've got three shows here in Helsinki with VV here at the Tavastia Club. So that's 29, 30, and 31 of December. Then I got pretty much the start of the year off. Then we finish the Neon Noir tour in New Zealand and Australia. And then we do another run around Europe. And the last thing on my book for this year is in April so far is the Royal Albert Hall with VV. So that's Royal Albert Hall. You know, it doesn't need to be anything else said there. I would hope after that hopefully I can line something up. But it's been a really successful 12 months. So I'm just gonna take what comes.
Yeah. That's absolutely class. That's absolutely fantastic. You've just said so many cool things there in like 30 seconds. I love it. For the love of God, would you ever just say hello to Sammy and Mike for me and tell them if they ever want to come on the podcast?
No problem.
I've messaged both of them. I literally have, and Wolfgang as well. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But Grant, well, I'll tell you what, let's head into a quick fire round of just some fun questions to finish up. Fun? Who am I? Just some silly questions just to finish, or not even silly questions, just some questions to finish off, just to, I don't know. I always call them like icebreakers at the end, but there we go. So here's one for you now with all your different time zones. Are you a morning person or a night person? Night person. Well, I suppose you'd have to be, but then what, like, is a night person in Helsinki going to be the same night person in Mexico with the time
zones? You know, just do your best not to sleep. It doesn't matter.
Fair enough. Have you got a favorite book?
Oddly enough, my favorite book is Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
That was the first one I read when I was 8. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Good stuff. Love it. What was the last song you listened to?
Let me check.
Go on.
Whatever. Listening history. Growing on Me.
Oh, can we just have a second to appreciate Permission to Land, by the way?
Yeah, well, the
what?
And 20th anniversary show next.
Yeah, I saw that. I spoke about it with someone on the podcast earlier on this year. I can't remember who it was, but it was just how perfect of an album Permission to Land was. And it was, let's finish off with one more question, and we'll say, let's do a really, really boring anticlimactic one. Tea or coffee?
Tea.
Tea. Good man. Barry's or Lines?
I'm just going to say Barry's just because we're here.
No. Give me the right answer now. Barry's or Lines?
Lines. All right.
Are you going for Lions? Yeah.
No. See, now this is the question of life. No, Barry's. Going with Barry's.
You're going with Barry's? No, good man. No, you have to, because Barry's is the correct answer. Not just because it's my name, but because
I didn't want to, you know. No, but
Barry's is the correct answer. Anyone else, they just get hung up on immediately, and their episode never sees the light of day. Andrew, it's been a delight having you on. If people are looking to have you manage their tour, or are looking to chat to you, or they just want to have a look at that stripy LTD George Lynch guitar, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Facebook. Just put my full name in. I'm the only one, apparently. So that's the easiest way of finding me.
Good man yourself. Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming on.
No, pleasure's been all mine.
That was the Music Career Show. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends about the Music Career Show.